Welcome to Building 72, the podcast brought to you by the Entertainment Arts and Engineering Program at the University of Utah. Thank you for joining your hosts, Adam Hunter and Corinne Lewis, to talk about the video game industry and, you know, probably other stuff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Building 72. We are super excited today. As you know, we have been talking to our alumni, and I think Chris is one of our most recent alumni. And so I'm super excited to see him because I very vividly remember us being in the same space a lot more frequently. So Chris, will you tell everybody hi and what you're doing right now?
Yeah, so my name is Chris, like Corinne was saying. I graduated 2 years ago now, I think, yeah. And I actually graduated with my bachelor's from the University of Utah also. So I have a master's and a bachelor's. I currently work for Obsidian as an associate technical artist. And previously I worked at 343 Industries as a environment technical artist.
That's awesome.
Obsidian, no big deal. Just like,
yeah, you know, just yeah, just a small studio.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Can you tell us what you're working on at Obsidian, or is it
like
grounded?
The project? Mm-hmm. No, I'm working on Avowed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if anybody's seen Avowed. It's a magic-based RPG. I don't know if I'm allowed to say more. So,
okay, you
know.
Don't say anymore. It's fine. We don't want to get you in trouble. We want you to stay at Obsidian forever. So.
Yes.
Well, that's why Chris and I have spent a lot of time together, because he came through our undergrad program and we went through Capstone kind of together.
Yeah, I think
I wasn't in Capstone. I was teaching Capstone, right? So
no, you were.
Well,
it was
the year
right before you. Yeah, because it was.
Right.
I think it was Bob.
Yep.
Roger.
And Gabe.
Gabe wasn't doing it either.
It was
just
Haley,
the two of them. No, it was just the two of them.
Oh, great.
Because I remember having a team difference and having to have a discussion with Roger.
Yes.
Roger being Roger, you know.
You know, that's actually part of the program, is every Capstone team has a problem. So,
well, I mean, it's no different than the industry. So,
yeah,
every team will have something.
Has there ever been a team where it's like, hey, everything's great and we shipped the game on time and everything, like nobody had any interpersonal problems or anything?
No.
Well, that's why it's designed that way, right? So you get a little bit of experience trying to work through personality conflicts.
Which, yeah, that's probably Roger's response actually has helped a lot, as weird as it sounds. His weird approaches do work. So
we won't
unorthodox.
Tell
him what you said.
It's unorthodox approaches.
Yes, unorthodox.
Yes. Roger definitely has an opinion about how you work through team dynamic issues.
Yeah, he does.
So here's actually a good question for you, Chris, to start off, because students ask me this all the time. With you having gone through the undergrad program and going through the grad program, what inspired you to take that next step into grad school? And then also, what were you taking out of grad school that either you didn't have in undergrad or that got polished from your undergrad? Like, what was the difference between the two programs beyond just one being grad school and then one being an undergrad?
Sure, I'll approach this question. So in undergrad, they didn't have a technical art field for me at the time. All it was the art under film, which honestly, I just didn't get enough out of. What I thought was going to be my last semester, which wasn't. I ended up having to do a semester during my first semester of grad school at the same time. So it was my second to last semester, I guess. I went to Brian Salisbury and told him what my dream was. And he looked me dead in my face and said, not possible. And I was like, oh, you know, I just wasted 3 years. And I thought, you know, oh, this is what I could do. And he was like, no, you're a good modeler. You just don't have the skills, but you could be a technical artist. And I was like, I don't want to animate at all. And he was like, well, that's not what they do. That's just what everyone thinks they do.
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening was I went and I took a independent study with Mark. And Mark had me basically in Maya write script to build a tool to build a piece of coral. And then halfway through, he was like, oh, no, this is not the leading industry stuff anymore. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I just spent all this time building this thing. And he's like, but you can still take that skill. And there's a program called Houdini. And I had never heard of it until, you know, that moment. And so once I started learning it, it actually became the thing that I loved doing the most. So I try to monitor myself as a procedural technical artist, but you know, that's just the thing I'm passionate about.
I remember when you first started getting into Houdini, I think that every other word out of your mouth was Houdini. Like, have you tried doing that in Houdini?
Yeah, Ryan and I talk on his stream a lot, and he's like, oh, hey, Mr. Houdini's here. Can you do this in Houdini?
Well, you really had so much passion for that, you know, program, and Mark made all those connections with the company and brought them in. And then just how, you know, you, I mean, that's one of the most awesome things when somebody really gets excited that they also share it with all the other teams and all the other, you know, people, the technical artists. So, you know, it's still going on. We still have students who are like, hey, have you heard about Houdini?
Yes. That's what I like to hear.
And we're one of Side Effects is, not charter schools, but there's a word for it that like we're one of their focus schools that they like how much we love Houdini. So,
well, yeah, it helps us so much. So is that, are you using that? Were you using that at 343? And is that how you think you got your job?
So at 343, okay, I'll do a quick background on what I did. At 343, what I actually handled was performance. So one of the things I didn't learn in school, which I think, I don't know if you can actually teach it, to be 100% honest, because you would have to build a game that is underperformant.
Right.
Make a performing game.
That sounds like every student game, Chris.
Oh, yeah. No, we had what actually got me the job at 343 was on our project, Hard Light Vector, we had outsourced to the VFX artist, and Sarab, I think it was Sarab, was pretty new at doing VFX, and he had not made it, so they died over time. And so what ended up happening was he got a memory leak, and that memory leak crashed our game randomly every 30 to 40 minutes. And, you know, it's kind of frustrating for a game. And so I dove in, figured out where the particle, like what was actually happening, realized the particle just wasn't dying. And so when I interviewed with them, they were like, oh, that's cool. We really like that because not many new technical artists have like the know-how to do that.
Right.
And then over there, I also worked, ironically, on animation. I did all of the multiplayer object animations. What else did I do? I did tools. I was a pretty generalist there. Over at Obsidian, I am more currently, because we're on pre-pro, we are doing a lot of tool development, just testing things. Mm-hmm. A lot of performance stuff like light map checking and that jazz. So
how do you describe what a technical artist is? Because I, you know, I always kind of parrot what Mark says, which is it's someone who's 60% an artist or 40% a programmer or 40% an artist and 60% a programmer. But I almost feel like those percentages aren't right anymore.
No. So we have, so he is correct. It's either you're a technical artist as an artist, or you're the technical artist. I fall towards the art just because I spent, you know, so long using Maya. I went and learned Maya and did all my stuff through art program at the U. And then, but basically a technical artist is someone who is willing to learn whatever they have to. So I know industry tools before they technically come out, obviously, like with Houdini. There's other programs that people can use. So like Blender is a major thing that I think a lot of students should learn, right, because a lot of studios are transitioning to it because it's free.
Right.
But at the core of what they are something. That's the thing that I think a lot of new technical artists fail on. I am a procedural technical artist. I know how to do procedural work. I am a lighting technical artist like Sarab. Mm-hmm. I am a tools technical artist like Yiming from Michael Hortworth. So that is what they are foundationally. They can do all the other things. Like foundationally, you should know how to do performance. Every technical artist in the industry can do performance because you're going to have to know why something's breaking. Every technical artist should know what a shader is, if you want 60 frames per second, why 16.9 milliseconds is important. Mm-hmm. Like those are things you should know foundationally, but you can't be taught those things because like you would have to build a bad game to know that those things need to be done.
Well, we definitely try to have you build bad games.
Yes. Yeah. But I think foundationally the school, it's a hard thing to teach because like no technical art class can sit here. You would have to have a technical artist who's already built the game, who has the broken builds of those games,
right,
and then
right.
say, hey, here's NDA stuff. Have fun.
Right. And
that just can't be done, unfortunately, yet.
Well, I guess I like to think that we taught you how to learn, which
yes.
And you certainly, I mean, your experience with Houdini is one, you know, stellar example of that, because I know that we didn't know, I mean, it was a new enough program that we didn't know how to use it, but you know, we try to put opportunities in front of you and you know how to teach yourself things now. So that's, you know, at least I hope that's what we're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that
depends on the day.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's every teacher at the U is a different personality. You can't expect, like Mark is very, he knows a lot, but he's very hands off. And so what ends up happening is if you just don't take the time to learn and you just do what he teaches you, you're never going to learn.
Yeah.
You're mimicking. Anybody can mimic. So
when you were mentioning kind of like those foundational things, a couple of students have asked specifically about like art fundamentals, things like, you know, composition, things like that. But specifically a couple of them have asked 2D art. Does 2D art have any place in technical art, or is it good to have a background, or is it just, are they apples and oranges at this point?
I mean, if you're doing 3D art, you should know 2D art, in my opinion. The foundations are all the same. Like, that's something that a lot of people, like, from a technical side of standpoint, like, if you're technical art, so you're the engineering, you typically don't have that foundation. Like, you kind of understand it, but it's just a foundation. Like, you don't know half the time what you're doing, but you know what a vector is, you know what a vector, a matrix, all those things. But I would say that they do have a world together, especially if you go the shader route. Mm-hmm. Shaders and lightings, technical artists require 100% more. Sorry, I'm like trying to like look at the camera at the same time.
No.
a lighting technical artist will inevitably need to know composition because that's what you're doing 95% of the time. A procedural technical artist, I don't care. My composition doesn't matter. Somebody else is making it look good. My belief as a technical artist has always been to support my artists and designers. That's my foundational belief. I'm not the guy who's going to make the pretty shader like Red Dead that allows people to walk in the snow and do weird stuff to that. I'm not the guy who's making the rope physics. I'm the guy who has built the underlying processes for you to do that. But at the end of the day, you're the one making it look good.
I love that. That is, I just have to ask a technical artist to explain that, because when I explain it, it's like, well, I think they do this thing called rigging. And I think they also do tools.
Yeah.
I mean, my understanding is slightly higher than that normally, but geez.
Yeah. And I think, so just on the rigging, I think every studio you're going to go to, no matter an indie studio or pro studio or AAA studio, their tools are all different. Mm-hmm. The whole point going back to the learning, if I didn't know how to foundationally learn, I wouldn't be able to keep up with the stuff going on because I'd have to spend all my time relearning everything. And so having that foundational skill of like animation, of shader work, which I think is now a core class the grad school.
It is
part of it. I don't know if it's the undergrad, but not, but yeah,
not yet.
Okay, yeah.
we need some more faculty.
Yeah, I know that one. Everybody needs more people.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
But yeah, no, those are the things that I think understanding the foundations is definitely an important part.
Have you noticed that there's a big difference between what expectations and stuff are between companies?
Oh, yeah.
or what definition technical artist means to different companies.
Right.
Yeah. So I'll use my real world experience. 343 is a AAA studio. That's what they are classified in the industry. Whereas Obsidian is a AA studio. So they're somewhere between indie and AAA. A AAA studio, 95% of the time, has minute like team. So this is the animation technical artist. This is the VFX artist. This is X artist. And so like I was a technical environment artist. But when you look at my job over here, there's only four of us compared to the 28 that was at 343. Wow. they're split between teams. So like you don't, and I didn't know this, but there's probably a little bit more because we have technical artists who do animation and that's a difference. But typically when you get down to the AA studios, you're going to be split between either environment or character. And so knowing a ton of environment stuff, knowing a ton of character stuff will get you to where you want to be, which is a thing that I think everybody should know a little bit about. So like know what you want to be. I know it's hard to say because I didn't know I wanted to be a technical artist, but at the end of the day, knowing that, hey, this is the thing that interests me, a company is going to look at you and be like, oh, you're interested in this thing. That means we can have you do this thing. We'll have you do other stuff, but this is the thing that you're interested in. So,
is that when you said you didn't know you want to be a technical artist, was it just like a light bulb one day where like you opened up Houdini and you were like, oh, this is my calling in life?
No, it was Brian telling me I couldn't be an artist.
Do you think he was right?
I have art in Halo, so I would argue no. But he wasn't incorrect in that at the time that I asked the question, was I capable of it? The answer is no. I'm not an artist. I can do the art, but I'm not an artist. I don't have the interest in building out height maps and all these other like art map things. They were just a means to an end. Whereas as a technical artist, it's not a means to an end anymore. It's about the things that I'm passionate about.
So you're really happy doing?
Oh, I'm so happy.
Oh, good.
I am glad Brian crushed my dreams.
You know, it's speaking from the, like on the other side of that, it's always because we have our, you know, good intentions, but it's hard to hear. It's hard to say actually, because, you know, I think we all think that if you work hard enough, you really can accomplish things, but art is very, you know,
subjective.
It's like, it's like, I don't know, Adam, if you feel the same way about this as a writer, but there is a craft component. You can get technically proficient, but there is a talent part too, that you have to have the creative vision and you have to be able to, you know, want all of that. And I mean, I'm sure that you're finding a lot of creativity in what you're doing now, which is great, but you know, it seems like you found the tools that are giving you the ability to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
Doing this other thing.
Yeah, and that really has helped, because so 343, before going to 343, I hated animation. Like, I hate weight painting. Weight painting is the worst thing on earth. But the way that they did animation, you didn't have to weight paint.
Huh.
And so I was like, I press a button and it does it for me, and it like 95% gets me there. I can get behind this. So
Did a technical artist write that button?
So that was created by, ironically, he was the lead technical artist in the whole studio. Oh. He got fed up with tools on 5 and then said, you know what? I'm going to build a new department. So he built the entire pipeline department, and they built like 95% of the tools now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty. They make life so much better. He is someone I consider a mentor. I talk to him probably once a month.
Nice.
Still. So.
Well, networks make a difference. So even if you change companies, you got to keep your network going.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to teach too.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. One thing I try and tell people, the thing that I think has made me successful is I'm just not afraid. Like, so you fail, congrats. Like, that's how you get better. Like, being afraid to go up to a human and being like, hey, I really like your piece of art, or hey, I really like the story you did, is so astronomically hard. But my fiance, or my wife / fiance's mom, is an English writer, and that's what she does. She just emails people and builds communication with like random authors, because all she did is just took the time to try. So
that sounds like a lot of what we just said in the video that Adam and I did about getting into the game career thing, getting into the industry. Cause it's, you know, we have people come to our lecture series and they always give us, you know, they always give out their emails and say, contact me, and nobody ever does. And we have said, like, look, that they wouldn't offer if they weren't serious.
Well, yeah. And so like, I'm on Ryan's Discord. We'll use Ryan as an experience. I'm on his Discord and I talk pretty regularly. And I've had one person reach out who's working towards possibly getting a job at 343, and he just wanted to talk. And, you know, that's all it takes, is message. And 90% of the time I'll message back. Like, I don't even know half the people on my LinkedIn anymore. They just add me. So
I'm fussy about my LinkedIn.
I was, but then I realized like I wanted this when I was going to school, having someone to reach out to, and I didn't have that. And so when I see kids reaching out from the University of Utah, I'm like, I'll add, you know. As a teacher, I assume it's a lot different, because like there's a lot of tape and other things you have to worry about.
Well, I'm also not really looking for a job unless somebody wants to tell me something, but I think so. But I, you know, LinkedIn is, I think LinkedIn is becoming more prevalent. I see a lot more people.
LinkedIn's really funny, because when it started like 13 years ago, it was big for like a second, and then it disappeared for like 6 years.
Yeah.
And nobody talked about it at all.
Well, it's interesting. They bought one of the tutorial sites. I think it was like lynda.com. I think they own it now.
Interesting.
And so what ended up happening was, what's that?
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. So they own it. And so once they bought it, I think it's like naturally to go to their thing. And it's like, the two things you should have no matter what as a technical artist is a website. Either you can code it, or you can be like me and be lazy and just do an art station. And you should have a LinkedIn, and you should be there's a fine line. And I think this is something you taught me actually with Samurai Crusader. There's a fine line between saying too much and saying just enough. And like on social media, I typically just repost stuff. I don't ever try and say anything. I don't post my political opinions. I have, like, obviously in my heart there are problems, but at the end of the day,
we all have our own opinions in our hearts. We don't have to share them with the whole world.
Right. And that's the thing I think a lot of people don't realize. Like, when you're new trying to get into the industry, you're not a Michael Moorheim. People are going to look at your social media and they're going to say, this person is overly aggressive in their communication. These are the things that they're doing, because I have to put what my social media, like when I apply to a job, it literally asks you, do you have a Twitter? Do you have a Facebook? Like, post their links here. So.
Yep. They want to make sure that you are not an HR nightmare.
Correct.
Well, so you mentioned two things. You mentioned LinkedIn, social media, and then you also mentioned like a website or an art station. Mm-hmm. For a technical artist, what kind of stuff should they be putting on their website or their portfolio?
Okay. So post what you are interested in. Do not just post things. That's one of the most frustrating things. So I'll have somebody message me and be like, hey, here's my art station. Take a look at it. First of all, art station can be organized. Don't just post like, do not just post everything because you're going to be judged on all of it. Like, hands down, that's just what's going to happen. So like, if you look at my LinkedIn, I have it actually folders. You can create folders and then you can click them and they'll take you to different pieces of art. So if you look at mine, I have my portfolio video, so my minute and a half reel. And then you can click and you can see my Unreal tools, my shaders, and my Houdini tools. And so you can, once you've looked at my reel and you're like, oh, I want to know more about how they did this, you can go in further and see everything. But really, that is what you should be doing, because I have seen some really bad art, and like, I'll message the person and be like, well, why did you put this here? Like, what was the reason? And they'll be like, cause it's something I made. And I was like, but you realize you're going to be judged on it. Andrew Ballridge, he is now a rock star. I think he's a environment technical artist, I think, or something like that. He and I talk a lot, and I helped him build his portfolio a little bit cleaner too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just know that people are going to judge you on your worst piece and your best piece, because that's all they can judge you by. They don't know you.
Right. Sure.
So when you're showing off like your Unreal tools and everything, are you showing off, you know, do you have a JPEG that's just a snippet of like the code side of it? Do you have here's a before and after? Like, how do you actually, because it's kind of hard to showcase a tool, right? It's kind of hard to be like, hey, here's this thing that I made. So how do you best go about showcasing something that you've made tool-wise?
So there's two ways. It depends on what the tool is. So judge the tools. Like, if you make a Maya tool, you're going to need to show the Python. You got to show that you can create clean code, because I'm going to, one way or another, I'm finding out. Like, if you send me your portfolio, I'm going to ask you to send, like, when I interviewed for EA Tiburon, they had me send Python code I wrote for every single tool I was showing.
Wow.
Even my stuff I wasn't showing, they're like, do you have anything else we'd like to judge you, you know, further? And I was like, I have an auto rig and all these other types of things. And they're like, just send it all. And so I sent them everything, because it was an NDA. Like, it was just school stuff I made. Or if you look at like an Unreal tool, show the blueprint, show that you can keep the cleanliness, show what it does. If you don't show what it does, I'm just looking at a wall of text. I'm like, I have no idea why you called these variables this. I have no idea why this node network is set up this way. So once I see what it's doing, I'll 95% of the time message you and be like, I like it, but could you do it this way? And then we'll start dialogue. And then, you know, now you have a connection. If you aren't the type of person who likes to just go up to people randomly and tap them on the shoulder.
Well, some people do that for sure.
Yeah.
So how much of your day, I mean, I guess maybe this is a dumb question because it's not either or, but like, can you tell us what you do during the day? Like, I always think of technical artists like, I'm doing art from this period to this period of the day, and then I'm doing programming from this period to this period. I don't think it works like that.
No.
Sorry, this is my art hour. I can't code right now.
So during production, so that would be 343, a lot of it came down to helping artists fix their problems 95% of the time. So I'd say I actually had in my backlog time dedicated to that because they knew it was going to be needed.
Right.
So, you know, 2 hours of my day for that, 3 to 4 to 5 hours doing performance checking. So there's that amount of time. And then depending upon the week, usually an hour to three doing meetings. And so I didn't really actually do anything other than that type of stuff. Early on when I was there, I did do tool work. I did a lot of the animation stuff. So I had to, on top of all that, I still had to fit in because it's like the multiplayer needs stuff. I still had to fit in time to do what they needed to do, because even though we had teams dedicated to it, those teams were working on campaigns. So they had to focus on that work. So I just said, okay, I'll take over. like, it's not a big deal. And then here, a lot of my day is watching YouTube. I know it sounds really weird, but I watch a lot of Houdini tutorials. And then I take portions from each of them and figure out, okay, this could work because of this. And we have a guy here who's like 100 times better than me at Houdini. And I am always messaging him. I've done light maps. So I check light maps maybe 2 hours a day, for every couple weeks. So it ranges. That's the thing I like about token card is I'm not just doing monotonous repetitive work. I'm thinking and trying to figure out how to solve a problem. So
do you feel that there's a lot of, we talked about creativity as a technical artist, do you feel there's a lot of creative freedom? And what I mean by that is, like, someone comes up to you with a problem and they just trust you to, like, Chris, I got this problem, please fix it for me. Like, is there that degree, or is there a, are you working within set parameters that you have to do, or is someone checking your tools, or how does that all go down?
So at 343, I earned the moniker of being a hard ass. What happened was at 343, everybody liked to talk through digital medium. So when I first got there, I'm not a digital person. I come off as very aggressive, very overbearing. I know that. It is what it is. I've had a lot of mentors try and teach me how to relax, so I get a little bit better at it, but I have this, that. And so what ended up happening was, when people had problems, I would just go to the person that made the problem 90% of the time and actually just say, hey, well, why did you do this, and why was this done, instead of just waiting for like an email or a message on Teams. I wasn't that person. But it comes down to answer the question, it comes down to how much you're respected and trusted. So 343, I was trusted. They gave me, when it comes out, I own two of brand new pipelines. So they trusted me to make all new pipelines for them. Oh. And then at Obsidian, I'm making tools, but, you know, I got to send them to people beforehand and check until I establish that trust that they know that they can just rely on me to get stuff done. So
were you contracted 343?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was contracted for 18 months. I was coming up on my contract before Obsidian called me back. And I had just had my first kid. So I was worried because I accepted a lower paying job because at the time I didn't know I was going to have a kid when I accepted. And so my wife is a stay-at-home mom right now, and so I needed a job to pay for that. And so I basically went to my contracting company and said, look, this is what I need a pay raise. Like, you guys got to help me. And so they're like, well, and my contractor was like, well, I'm leaving, you can just have my dividend. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, I don't know how much that is. And he's like, oh, it's a $13,000 increase. I was like, what the F? How are you getting that much off of me?
Wow.
Yeah. And so he was like, don't even like worry about it. Like, the next job you get, you're probably going to be making a ton of money. And so I'm moving to Obsidian because I never actually accepted that position because I was already interviewing, and I felt relatively okay about my Obsidian interview because right. I had applied. Okay. Let's see. So I've been applying. I knew in February, right after my kid was born, that I needed a new job because I didn't think my wife was going to be able to go back to work originally because we wanted to raise our daughter. So I started applying. I applied to 186 companies. I had 52 interviews. I'm doing this not to be cocky. I'm doing it because I think people need to realize, like, if you want to work in this industry, you just got to accept the defeat. It's yeah. the hardest thing you can do. And then I had 18 second interviews, and then 5 end interviews. When I got hired here, I actually turned down another position at Treyarch because I had for my dog. Like, it really came down to what I wanted. I like what Obsidian's goals are and I liked what Treyarch schools were, but having a network really let me know how Treyarch's work hours were, and they just didn't really fit with family. And so I ended up choosing Obsidian because I liked the people they, and this is going to sound egotistical, but I like Microsoft. I don't care what anybody says. Like, Microsoft does everything they can for their employees. So COVID happened. We'll use COVID as a great example. And I had just come back from paternity, and I walk in, and my boss, who is the art director, comes up to me and he says, "I need to talk to you." And I'm like, "Well, crap. Like, what did I do? Like, I just came back a week ago." And he's like, "I'm sending you home." And I was like, "Wait, what? Like, why are you sending me home? Like, I just came back." And he's like, "I don't want you getting sick, even if it pretend," because it was the first deaths were in Washington.
Yeah.
And he was like, "We're sending you home. Wow. You can work from home. Just, you know, clock me and we'll figure out how to get you up and running. But that is that. Like, you're going home. I don't want you getting sick." And so I was home. So I haven't even been in an office working since February or March of this year. So.
Wow.
Yeah, it's hard working from home.
It is hard working from home. I think we're all struggling, but man, I'll tell you, everybody is in the same boat. It's like, we are all trying to figure out how to stay motivated when the fridge is right there.
Oh, yeah. Microsoft in office, they basically, and this is only Microsoft's corp areas. So Redmond and Seattle, they actually just provide you with free drinks. Like, they just have fridges of drinks. And then they have a cafeteria in one of the buildings, and the cafeteria is like maybe $6 for like a gigantic foot long. So like, I was getting fatter in office because I was drinking 4 to 6 sodas a day.
Whoa.
Well, I was trying to cut back on Red Bull because I'm trying to cut back on one thing, and instead I was just ingesting sugar instead.
So. Well, and now you guys moved too, right? You're in LA?
So we're in Irvine.
In Irvine, yeah.
Irvine area. We're in this little town called Rancho Santa Margarita. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like 15 minutes from Irvine. I'm going to go on a little soapbox. I apologize. But if you want to work in the games industry, you got to be willing to move. Like, no city, every city comes and goes. Like, the major hubs you're going to want to work in: LA, Chicago,
Austin,
and Seattle and Austin.
Those
are the American companies. If you have Canadian ability, go to Montreal or
Toronto.
Quebec.
Yeah.
Toronto. Yeah. There is, I can never remember the city above Washington, the big
Vancouver.
Vancouver is also huge. But yeah, like, if you go to Florida, 90% of the time you're going to be at EA Tiburon.
Yep.
They have some other studios there, but that's what you're going to do. New York, you're going to be a rock star. Oh, Massachusetts, they have Bethesda's there. So
ZeniMax, yeah. But now they're a Microsoft company. So yeah. Who knows?
You know, we just like to buy everybody.
Okay. I know. Well, it's certainly how Xbox games got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Although, to your point, Chris, about COVID and then about people caring for the families, I think, like, for the upcoming, well, I mean, for anybody looking for a job in the game industry kind of from now on, the question that someone should ask a studio was, what was your studio's response to COVID? Because I think that's going to cue people in on where their values were placed, how they handled it. I think that's we sent our employees home so they didn't get sick. Like, that's a huge thing to hear as a potential employee that they care about that.
Yeah, Microsoft. So I love Microsoft. So Microsoft, we were the first, one of the earliest companies to send people home. Our projected timeline to come back isn't until at least January 14th. So they were sending out memos weekly from the CEO. I can never remember his name. Satya. He would send out emails weekly.
Satya Nadal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He would send out emails constantly saying, "Hey, this is the plan. worldwide, like telling everybody the plan. Didn't matter what country you're in. I think Philippines, they were hit early on. And so then he could shut them down really early and said, don't worry about it. We're just going to pay you. Don't even care. And then there are other studios that I have heard of that didn't do it until their state decided to close down. So it's a good thing, I think, Adam, for people to ask.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. I think it'll be because there are studios that, like, if you're going to work for a place and, hey, what was your company's response to COVID? And it was like, we plowed through it, all worked in the office, everything. It's like, maybe that's not where I want to hang my hat for a while.
Yeah.
Well, we are almost out of time. Can you believe that?
No, it seems like no time.
I know, it just goes by so fast like that. Yeah. But we always like to end with just one question, which is if you could go back in time and give yourself advice about this job, or if you want to just give advice to some of our current students, do you have any words of wisdom for students who'd like to become technical artists in the industry?
Yeah, I have like three things, I guess. First, don't be afraid to move. Like, you need to move. Like, if you want to get to the technical, like, I want to be a technical art director, I'm going to have to move if I need to. Second, don't be afraid of failing. That's the only way you're ever going to learn. And especially as a technical artist, I am up, this is something I shouldn't say because my company would get mad, but I'm up studying for 4 hours even after I'm off the clock, just because I'm trying to learn as much as I can and fail as much as I can. And then lastly, don't be afraid of reaching out to people. Like, if you don't know someone, someone will know someone and they can help you. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, that is fantastic advice. I wholeheartedly agree with all of those things.
Yeah, my dad's an old-timey person, so he's my grandfather, and so he took us in, and, you know, he taught me, you know, failure is failure. It's what you do with that failure that defines you. So.
Well, I've been listening to and reading several books over this break, and one of the things that they talk about is failing and being vulnerable, letting yourself be vulnerable, not being perfectionists, really is a hallmark of being creative, because you have to, you know, you have to be empathetic, and you can't have empathy without being vulnerable. And so it's kind of a circular, it feels like a circular logic there, but I love that idea, because, you know, we are all creative, especially in the game industry. And it's really important to stay creative, which means you have to be okay with failure, you know, because that's how we learn.
Yeah. And so my child, I thought everything was going to end. Like, I was just going to find a job and have to do everything. But my child's actually motivated me more, because I realized I have to fail more to give her opportunities that I want her to have. So.
Well,
yeah.
So reach out to people, don't be afraid of failure, and have a kid.
No, don't have a kid.
Maybe I will not tell you, in that order. I don't know. Yeah.
Make sure you want to have a kid. They're not easy things to take care of. She is sick. She got us sick. And so I have never experienced a child being sick.
It's hard.
Hardest outside of the first like month of pregnancy, hardest moment I've had yet.
Well, it's really hard to see a little kid suffer and not be able to do anything about it. And it's also really hard when you're suffering your own. And it's really, the other thing, Chris, is really hard. Wait till she starts running. It's really hard to see kids figure out physics.
Yeah, she started. So we were worried she wasn't going to crawl. And so she started crawling.
Yeah, gravity. Gravity's rough on kids.
Yeah, her butt is bruised. So
it happens. Yep, it's hard. I don't even have kids, and I have enough nephews and nieces. I know.
I was gonna say the joke, Corinne. I worked on a Alvin and the Chipmunks game that was rated like a 1.2. I know how hard it is to see kids suffer.
That's right. Well, Chris, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on, and I am sure that everyone's going to love hearing all about what you're doing.
I hope so. And like I said, just reach out if you want to talk. I can just ask Corinne. I can send her my email or LinkedIn or Discord, any of those.
Absolutely. So. Sweet. Absolutely. Thanks again, Chris.
No problem. Chris.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.